I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Last week, the National Institutes of Health proposed lifting its moratorium on funding for research that injects human cells into the tissues of other animals. The NIH had halted the funding to consider the ethics of creating animals with human organs, chimeras, if you will. Researchers say the goal is to treat illnesses and diseases, including creating organs for transplantation. We'll be talking with one of those researchers later in the show, but first, what are some of the ethical issues at stake? And joining us by Skype is Monica Piotrowska, and she's an assistant professor of the philosophy of biology at the University of Albany. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
So we know what a chimera is when it comes to Greek mythology. What is a chimera in the lab?
So a chimera in the lab is an animal that's composed of two different populations of cells, where each population was on its way to developing a unique individual. So we could have a developing mouse, and we can have a developing human at very early stages of development. And we can take some of the human cells from that developing embryo and inject them into the developing mouse. And if that animal were to develop and be born, that animal would now have two different populations of cells with two different genetic identities, one mouse and one human.
Did you favor the NIH, and this was about a year ago, essentially halting the public funding, the taxpayer funding for this kind of research to give perhaps everybody a chance to catch their breath and figure out what some of the ethical and perhaps medical scientific issues are?
Certainly. As a philosopher, I favor any discussion about the ethics or the bioethics of something coming on the scene. And I think what prompted NIH to put a stop to the funding briefly was the fact that a lot of advances have been coming our way from genetic side of things. And I think they wanted to say, okay, things are moving so much quicker now. Let's pause. Let's rethink, reconsider. In the end, the recommendations look to be very similar to the recommendations prior to the moratorium. But I think it was good to put the brakes on. And also, I mean, there's still a month left for people to put in feedback from the general public since this is a public good.
Does this, though, and perhaps this is looking more into the future, does it break down then the wall, the divide, if you will, between human beings and non-human animals?
Well, I think this is exactly the question that's of interest to bioethicists. So, I think one way of asking ourselves about these chimeras is to ask, are these animals with human parts or are they part human? Now, why would it matter if it's just a pig with, let's say, a human pancreas, as opposed to something like a part human pig? Well, the reason why it matters is because our ethical guidelines for research on animals are based on a human-non-human dichotomy. If you're a non-human animal, like a pig or a bird or a rat, you can be used in research for the purposes of ending human suffering, even if that research causes you harm, even if that research sacrifices your most fundamental interests, including your life. If you're a human, on the other hand, you have quite a bit of protections on the research side of things. We would never sacrifice you for the well-being of other human beings, and you have the luxury to refuse to participate in any research for any reason. So if there are such drastic differences in research ethics, how do we know who is human and who is not human? How are we going to figure out who we're going to protect and who we're not? And the way we've done it so far before chimeras came on the scene was we asked, well, we can just, by looking at you, we can tell you're human, or we can check for human DNA, or we can look to see if you can give rise to human offspring. All of these would be indicators of you being a human. But now human, non-human chimeras have the potential to satisfy each criteria. They can have human appearance, they can have human DNA, and they can have the ability to create human sperm and human eggs. Now, go ahead.
Well, yeah, just to follow up, and that's actually very provocative to think about, and this is a very sort of rough question here, but let's say what do we call them? Animals? I guess that's part of the issue.
They are animals. I mean, humans
they're
animals.
Animals. Okay. Yeah, we're animals. Yeah. They're animals. So if something is 51%, let's say, human and 49% pig, what are we talking about here?
Well, exactly. This is exactly the right question to ask. That is what, well, this is what I think is going on. So I think this is giving us an opportunity to reconsider this human-non-human dichotomy. If anything, the merging of human and non-human animals should make us question why it is that if you're human, you get this special treatment, and if you're not human, you don't, especially as it becomes harder and harder to say who is human from even a biological perspective.
Well, I'm also thinking about what we have learned about great apes and elephants and pigs and other animals, the parts of our understanding of animal welfare, of their ability to have empathy, as some have said, caretaking, things that we would recognize as being rather like us.
Yeah, and I think that's a better guide to how animals should be treated. I think the human-non-human dichotomy is probably not a good working model, but it's the one we have on the books. I think it's better to figure out what each individual is capable of, and certainly mental capacities are the ones that are of most interest. So if I'm kicking a chair, for example, nobody says I'm doing something wrong because that chair is incapable of feeling pain. But if I kick something that has the capacity to feel pain, now that individual is capable of being wronged in a particular way. Mm-hmm. And so with chimeras, the same question arises. If a chimera, and there was an experiment in 2013 where mice were injected with human glial cells, which is a particular kind of brain cells. And these glial cells effectively repopulated the brain of the mice so that all of the glial cells were of human origin. And the mice were born, and then the mice were tested on various kind of maze tests to see how well they could perform. And they turned out to be significantly better at learning and remembering than mice that have not been tampered with. And so now if we see these kinds of mental changes in a mouse, we might now think maybe this mouse is now capable of being harmed in ways that it couldn't have been harmed before.
That's such fascinating research. And it obviously underscores how, and this is, this goes without saying, how important the brain is in our ability to do things and to think and to, I guess, feel as well.
That's right. We generally, the brain really has a lot of the aspects that we consider to be morally relevant, because like I said, they are the things that make us entitled to certain things, make us have certain interests, or make us suffer in ways that other things can't.
I'm wondering if we can use then genetic testing genetic testing to figure out, okay, just at what point or at what part of this animal is quote unquote human?
Yeah.
Can we do that?
Well, we can test, this is a big question of what does it mean to be human? And I think this is exactly the problem. Now, and the interesting thing when it comes to chimeras is you can test a particular body part of a chimera and it might show up as mouse and another part might show up as human because the cells may populate different parts of the body. And we have naturally occurring chimeras even in humans. So normally when a human egg is fertilized, somebody gives birth to a child. And if two human eggs are fertilized, usually somebody gives birth to twins. But on occasion, instead of giving birth to twins, as these two human eggs are fertilized during conception and they start to develop, they can merge together and form one individual that will, in a sense, have another individual in itself. Yeah. And if you were to test the blood of that individual, it might come up with one genetic identity. But if you were to test that individual's kidney, for example, it'll show up with a different genetic identity. So most people who are chimeras actually have no idea that they're chimeras because it's something you wouldn't normally know.
I feel like I've seen that movie somewhere. So you've laid out some of these really fascinating and important ethical issues that are at stake. Do you see us coming to some kind of consensus on research using chimeras?
Well, it seems that NIH has come to a consensus because they're not changing much since the moratorium. So it seems that they seem to be saying okay to research that involves the introduction of human embryonic stem cells into all animals, basically, besides primates. When it's early on, they're saying, no, primates are a different story. They're too closely related to us. But when it comes to research on the brain specifically, when the interest is to mimic something like Alzheimer's disease to help us study that disease and chimeras, primates are actually allowed in such research if the introductions of human cells is done later on in development. And the other interesting aspect that they're saying okay to is they're now saying we can produce, let's say, a pig that generates human sperm and human eggs, because studying human sperms and human egg might help us with learning about human fertility issues, for example, as long as such animals are not allowed to breed, because there are obviously worries about a pig, you know, giving birth to a human being.
And the idea that if that were to be bred with another similar type animal, then we really would be in a whole different ballgame.
Exactly.
So one of the criticisms, and we're going to have a little bit later in the show someone that does some of this research, and their concern was that when the NIH put this halt on the funding to take a look at some of these ethical issues, that really threw off the research and made it more difficult to do the research, which hopefully will have some kind of benefits. Are you sympathetic to that?
I think certainly there are benefits to this research. So lots of people, the kind of hot area for research currently is the production of organs people are also interested in studying human disorders of the brain, but the potential to create human organs is becoming real very quickly because of these genetic advancements. And I think there are lots and lots of people waiting for organ donations. Every year people die because they don't have an organ donor. And so there's the potential to use a non-human animal for that purpose. I'm hesitant to answer what I think of this from an ethical perspective, because I think there are a lot of animal welfare concerns that we have even when it comes to eating meat, using humans for our purposes and not considering their interests. And so here I think is an example of, well, we're using a kind of biofactories. We're using, living factories for parts that we want.
Well, we're almost having a break here, and I always believe in openness and transparency, and the more information, the better. You know, for the most part, people don't want to know where their meat comes from. They don't want to go to one of these factories to see where their meat comes from, and they probably don't want to go to a lab either.
That's right. I think we prefer to be blind to all of it, but I'm, as an ethicist, I think that's probably not the right approach.
Well, let's take that short break. And I want to get some callers and commenters in on our conversation, talking about the idea of chimeras in the laboratory. It's an issue that the NIH has been grappling with, halted some funding about a year ago. It's now looks like they will resume the funding. This would be public funding for the kind of research using these human and animal chimeras, raising a whole host of really interesting ethical medical questions. And our guest is Monica Piotrowska, and she's an assistant professor of the philosophy of biology at the University of Albany. Give us a call. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We know what chimeras are in Greek folklore, part lion, part goat, part snake. But now it has moved into the world of science, into the laboratory. Researchers have been introducing human stem cells or cells into animal embryos to be able to treat diseases, create organs for transplantation. The NIH did put a halt on some of that research until recently, now considering a policy change. We thought it'd be really interesting to talk about some of the ethical issues involved, and that's why we called up Monica Piotrowska from the University of Albany. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Monica, we've talked about pigs. We've talked about mice. What are the animals that generally end up in this kind of research?
So Well, mice are a very common target, but now pigs are the popular ones now because there are a lot of similarities between pigs and humans. And because size-wise, when it comes to organ transplants, we're looking for an animal. You know, it's going to be hard to get a kidney transplant from a mouse when the kidney is going to be tiny. It's not going to do much good for human beings. So you're looking for an animal that is a comparable size so that when the organ has a chance to grow, you can then transplant it to a human being. And the way geneticists have been able to do that is they can manipulate the cells of the pig as it's developing so that it, in the end, will not develop a pancreas. If it were to just be born, it would be born without one. So there's a niche created, a kind of emptiness, and then you inject the human embryonic stem cells in early development, and those cells then occupy that niche and create that organ.
Fascinating. And what are the organs that seem to develop or do well under this kind of research, under this kind of science?
So the pancreas is the one that has done well recently, and there's been some excitement over it because there's potential for people with diabetes to be able to have use for it. But kidneys and hearts are also potential organs. Now, there's also worries with how do we know for sure if these cells are injected into a developing pig? How do we know for sure they won't affect the brain of the pig? Can we really trust the science that that nothing else will be altered? And I think here I have to give credit to the scientists because they're working hard at making sure that things are as uncontroversial as they can be. And what they can do is they can manipulate the human cells in a way so that they're effectively have something that they refer to as suicide genes, wow, which will cause these cells to kill themselves, essentially, if they start trying to turn into brain cells so that they know their place is in the pancreas and they're not, in a sense, allowed to go anywhere else.
A suicide gene, if you will?
Yes.
That's what they call it. Let me read an email from Helen. If we can categorize a hierarchy of humanness in animals, can we not categorize the degree of humanness in humans? What decides such things? Eugenesis is ethics only related to people. Who speaks for the other species on this planet? And in many ways, Mon, I think that that's sort of what this conversation is about. And I think that's also what some of the ethics are about. Who speaks for the animals?
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, we've taken it for granted that as long as you're of a human species, you get all these protections, even if you can't speak for yourself. But we haven't extended the same courtesy to non-human animals, merely in virtue of them not belonging to our species. And now as we're merging, this species divide is kind of disappearing in a sense through this research. Is the mere fact that you belong to a species, is that going to be enough for you to get protections from us? Or should we stop thinking in this way? Should we stop thinking that it's this dichotomy between human and non-human?
And I'm again looking into the future. Let's say these organs are available for transplantation. The act of choosing to have this organ put in your body, in a sense, gives tacit approval to this kind of research. How should people wrestle with that?
Well, you know, there's been some research done on how people feel because so currently there are human beings who have a pig heart valve, for example, right, implanted in them. And we haven't thought of them as part pig. We continue to think of them as humans with a pig part. But there, you know, I'm not as familiar with the research, and this isn't kind of in sociology about human perception of getting organs from non-human animals, but I think it's an interesting area to look into.
Let me see if I can get one more caller on before we have to say goodbye to you, and then we've got a guest waiting in the wings here, and let's get our caller up and go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there. That's you. That's you.
All right. My question is this. When determining human versus non-human organisms, what are the implications with regards to persons with disabilities in determining what one is capable of understanding and processing and feeling versus, say, an animal? I'm not trying to make the...
Sure.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And let me see what our guest has to say. Monica, go ahead.
Well, so actually, I'm not sure if I'm clear on the question. Is the question that if a person is disabled,
yes,
are they in some sense not fully human or something?
Yes,
like
I think
that?
That's sort of at the root of the question. If we're talking about people's abilities as humans to be able to do certain things or think certain way or have certain kinds
right.
of feelings.
Okay, I understand. Okay. So yeah, I think, well, again, I think this speaks to the point that I'm trying to kind of drive home here, that I think the human-on-human divide is the wrong way to think about things because, yeah, people have different abilities. They have different ways of feeling things, of experiencing things, and it should be based on what is it that you're capable of, and those should determine how you ought to be treated. What is the morally right way of treating you? What kind of benefits should be given to you because of the various aspects that you're capable of doing.
We're going to have to end on that note. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're very welcome. And again, Monica Piotrowska, Assistant Professor of the Philosophy of Biology at the University of Albany. Well, as I said, the NIH announced that it was going to lift its moratorium on funding for animal-human studies, create some new policies for this kind of research. And we asked Sean Wu to join us, director of the Sean Wu Lab, associate professor of medicine at Stanford Medicine. And Sean Wu, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Tell us about the research you've been doing.
The stem cell lab that I run has been looking at ways that we can understand how genes function in heart development, and we actively utilize the chimera assay, which has existed for more than 20 years. But that has so far involved injecting mouse stem cell into mouse embryos, and that approach, which many people currently use as well, allows us to understand how genes function during developmental process so that we can identify ways to correct those gene defects by either using drugs or potentially by correcting the gene defect itself. And this particular experiment involving chimera has been something that generated a tremendous amount of knowledge. And recently, within the last 10 years, the development of human stem cells has started allowing scientists to ask questions about whether we are also able to understand human development through these human stem cells. But the challenge for human, obviously, is that we cannot do this in human models. So the animal model, which we have utilized using mouse stem cell and now other large animal species like pigs and sheep, has become an area that people begin to wonder if it was possible to gain better knowledge of how the human stem cell and, in essence, human embryo would develop through the use of animals in these kinds of studies.
Well, and I want to talk to you a little bit more about the research, but do you wrestle with some of the ethical ideas and issues that we were just wrestling with our bioethicist about things like consent? And at what point does, and I'm looking into the future, obviously, but when you begin to sort of mix humans and other animals, are there ethical questions for you?
Yes, tremendous, which I think is why the NIH had initially placed the moratorium back last September, because it was just unclear as the way the science had been progressing, and science had progressed quite rapidly in recent years, whether or not doing experiments such as the ones that I was mentioning would be considered ethically responsible, and also how, if people would consider that there is a path and value to do this, how should we approach that? And I think what the NIH has come to in various different discussion among scientists and ethicists and also with the public has concluded that there is a path that could be moved forward, but it has to be carefully guarded given the potential concerns, you know, from various constituents.
Well, I'm thinking about issues of consent. As our guest was saying, humans can give consent if they want to be part of a research study. Obviously, animals can't and don't give consent. How do you wrestle with that idea?
Well, it is a tremendous challenge in trying to find out how to work with animal model in a way that's humane and ethical. And we have built into the research system a very stringent process to determine whether animal research should proceed. And there are animal institutional review boards that looks at every protocol that is being devised and proposed to study in animal research at every institution. Certainly, I think it's a much bigger discussion in general about whether animals should or should not, you know, be used in research at all. But I think as it stands, and the tremendous value that we have gained in knowledge and also in the ability to treat human, We certainly right now can foresee that there are certain advantages of using animal that we otherwise just could not do with any other alternative system. But as you mentioned, this is a difficult area, I think, ethics-wise, especially now involving human and animal, which is why I think this extra panel that's going to review all proposals at the NIH is going to try to help decide, what would be considered appropriate and what would not.
Do you call these animals that you work with, do you call them chimeras yourself?
Well, the chimera word has been used scientifically in this research model. So I think it's somewhat unfortunate since it came with quite a negative connotation in literature, but as it sort of stood, that has been the word both in the scientific literature and among the lingo for scientists to describe this kind of work.
I'm interested in what you're hoping to be able to do. You mentioned the fact that you're working on heart issues. Is transplantation, is that what you're, the future, the goal of what you're doing?
Yeah, so there are various different levels of what people hope to achieve from this kind of research. At the most fundamental level is to try to understand how human development occur at the very earliest stages. As I had said earlier, since we cannot do this in any other model that would support the development of a human stem cell, the very early stage human development through the stem cell has to involve a host that would allow the human stem cell to progress through the very early stages. And the interest that scientists have is to try to figure out how that would work in early embryo in animal to, as a host that would essentially grow as a womb for the human stem cell and watch that very early stages of stem cell development. And the long-term interest for that is there are genetic diseases that causes early miscarriages and also infertility and stillbirth. And we just don't understand what might be the reason for that to happen. And these early embryo death may be understood better if we have a way to figure out how human genes and defect works in that very early stage embryo. And we're talking about embryos at such early stage that there's really no recognizable organ structure. So there's no arms or, no heads that you really recognize so well in that very early stages in the embryo. But it's at that stage mainly for understanding the science of how normal genes would function at that point in development. There are certainly interests for later stage development in a chimera assay, and as was mentioned earlier from Monica about generating organs, there are now some really interesting work that have come out to give us a sense there may be a possibility, and I want to very clearly say maybe, just because we're so early in this research work that no one can really predict whether or not this is actually going to take all the way down to the point where you might actually put a human stem cell into animal and be able to generate specific organ that would actually match perfectly to the human cells. There have been some animal models. So Professor Nagalchi here at Stanford University has shown that the generation of the pancreas using a rat cell put into a mouse host, and the rat and the mouse are quite similar, and that they were able to generate this kind of organ. We're interested in my lab in generating hearts, and as it stands, it would be a tremendous challenge to really know how to actually make that work. We can do so from the mouse-to-mouse chimera so far. We just don't know how it's going to be if you take that further into different species.
Sure. Let me read a comment here from an email from Elizabeth. One thing I'm not hearing anything about in this conversation is the issue which are the issues that have tripped up so many cases where we do not know generally until disaster strikes what crossover diseases will occur, what completely unanticipated outcomes will occur when we jump into these fields. Something you wrestle with. I use that word a lot with you, Sean Wu.
So definitely the issue of potential infections that normally does not come into human until when you start crossing species in a mixing experiment like this certainly is possible, I think, especially involving transplanting something that is being hosted by an animal into human. And there's been a lot of concerns back in the days when people had tried xenotransplant, essentially trying to utilize the organ from an animal to do transplant into humans directly. So far, at least from those very early experiments, it has been very sort of carefully monitored, but that there was no animal infection that has come along into the recipient, although those have been such rare experiments that, you know, we just don't know if there's going to be more possibility for infection coming to human. And I think those are very valid concerns that we need to look very carefully in these research.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, the NIH has called for a ban on breeding chimeric animals. Do you support that?
Yes, I think generally among all scientists, the idea of breeding animals which have human germ cell is considered, you know, quite distasteful. And I think that is very much consistent with view of the scientific community as far as having any human germ cell into breeding.
We have a call. We can't take it. Unfortunately, Mary Jane from Doylestown says, I'm a cancer survivor, and one of the drugs I took was a chimera antibody. Does that surprise you, Sean Wu?
No. So, again, this is regarding the use of the word. So now many, many cancer antibodies that are now quite effective have been generated out of what's called humanized mouse models. So essentially human DNA for those antibody inserted into the mouse genome so that the mouse could be producing a human version of the antibody so that they won't be rejected when given continuously. And that, in essence, is one example of how the use of animal for human therapy has come about and has been tremendously effective.
And I got to jump in here only because they're playing my song. We're out of time. Sean Wu, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. Director of the Sean Wu Lab, Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford Medicine. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, another day, another week, another controversial comment by Donald Trump. Here's a montage of some of his statements that have drawn fire from his critics, including Republicans.
Written by a nice reporter. Now the poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember. He's going like, I don't remember. Maybe that's what I said.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her, wherever.
Mexico, and I respect Mexico, I respect their leaders. What they've done to us is incredible. Their leaders are so much smarter, so much sharper, and it's incredible. In fact, that could be a Mexican plane up there. They're getting ready to attack.
Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here. That's all right. Don't worry. I think she really believed me that I love having a baby crying while I'm speaking.
If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Trump and his supporters often explain these statements by saying it was just a joke. And looking at the people at Trump's rallies, they find him highly entertaining. We asked Jody Avregan to join us, a podcast host and producer at 538. And Jody, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And I should just say Donald Trump is speaking at the National, or was just speaking at the National Association of Home Builders in Miami. And he repeated his claim that President Obama is a founder of ISIS.
So Isn't it nice when you have a news hook for every conversation you want to have about Donald Trump saying something that causes a little bit of a stir?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because I think a lot of people wrestle with this is, you know, how often and how much do you cover something like this? And is it responding to every single thing that gets said? Or as we have in this montage, a kind of compilation of some of his greatest hits. How do you know, though, Jody, when Donald Trump is telling a joke? Or can you?
You don't. Anyone who claims to probably doesn't know. But I do think, and this is kind of what I've been mulling, that there are moments when Donald Trump is, at least in his estimation, making a joke. He actually has this thing he talks about in his events a lot. He says, you know, aren't we having fun, folks? Isn't this fun if you go there? And I think he genuinely thinks that he has a role as an entertainer. And so I think that one thing that the media should do, and I know that's a tricky thing to say, the media, but
yeah,
one thing the media should do
always,
is recognize those moments when Donald Trump is joking and those moments when he's really saying something that is dangerous. Both, by the way, I should make clear, are dangerous, right? We can have a conversation about whether we want our leaders to be joking about this stuff. But my concern is that when there is the equal amount of response and froth and consternation over every Donald Trump statement, it sets him up to do something which plays right into his wheelhouse, which is dismiss the media whole cloth and say they totally didn't get that baby thing was a joke. They totally didn't get that Mexican plane thing was a joke. Those two things were in your montage. And he gets to lump in the reaction to that with the reaction to his comments about Megyn Kelly or his going after the New York Times reporter Serge Kovaleski or his comments about Second Amendment supporters going after Hillary Clinton. And that is basically at the heart of his campaign is this dismissal of the media whole cloth.
And you're saying, again, speaking broadly, the media tends to, as we did in that montage, tends to lump everything together. But I would sort of add on top of that, it seems like there are certain things that Donald Trump has said that have been repudiated in many ways by Republicans, members of his own party, his criticism of Judge Curiel, for one thing. Even the statement about the Second Amendment and Hillary Clinton has gotten a lot of pushback. So in the sort of back and forth with Donald Trump, some of this stuff does rise to the top.
For sure. And if you look at the polling, which we're 538, we tend to look at the polling, some of those comments, the Judge Curiel comment and, you know, the fight he picked or however you want to characterize it with the cons after the Democratic convention, those genuinely hurt him. But then every day, you know, there's the new little quip. And to some extent, Trump creates this chaos, but also thrives in it. He knows how to play that game. He knows how to kind of maneuver. Well, he's not doing very well in the polls, so maybe he doesn't. But he thinks he knows how to maneuver when there is just a constant churn. And again, my point is that it's worth pausing to think about the stuff that really has an impact and should really scare us and the other stuff which is, you know, just an aside as in his eyes.
Well, and as we all know, one of the criticisms of the media has been its relentless coverage of Donald Trump over the last year, the kind of free, I think, $2 billion worth of so-called free media that he has gotten. And I guess the question is, Jody, is how to cover him and his candidacy. Have you figured that out?
No, I have not. If you figure it out, let me know.
I will.
But I think that it is all I'm advocating for is simply slowing down a little bit and realizing kind of what merits real coverage and what can take a pass. Like, why is there a rule that every silly thing that Donald Trump says needs to create a 24-hour media cycle? Maybe Donald Trump should say something to the 1,000 people in his audience and we move on. Or maybe not every single thing he says in a speech should become a sort of national story. I do really kind of want to point out that Trump is obviously perpetuating this degradation of the media or whatever we want to call it, but he's mostly a product of it, right? He's mostly taking advantage of the fact that we have this media landscape where it's entirely based on churn and froth. Social media, I think, is, you know, frankly, a big part of it. But even mainstream media is built on just finding the next shiny thing and chasing that thing and regenerating every 24 hours, if fewer.
Well, how do you wrestle with this? I mean, as I said, we on this show wrestle with it, I think, every single day. How do you do it, Jody? You've got a podcast.
Yeah, well, our podcast only comes out once a week.
So I mean, that helps, right?
I think that is, you know, if you're looking for super simple like answers to why some media is problematic and some media is not, the amount of space that needs to get filled is a pretty good metric. And so if you just look at your show, which is only once a day for 2 hours, right? Our show, which is only once a week, our blog, our site, 538, which only publishes a couple pieces a day, we have the opportunity, I'd like to think, to be a little more thoughtful and pick our shots. Whereas, you know, CNN, like, they have to fill 24 hours a day. And sometimes there are not 24 hours a day worth of news. And so then what do you get?
Well, actually, I'm looking. The TV's at MSNBC. Trump, I believe more Clinton emails are coming. And it looks like Governor Richardson is the guest. And you're right. When it comes to cable, they've got the 24/7 to fill. And it seems that they can fill it. I don't know what their ratings are, but it seems like they can fill it pretty much 24/7 Donald Trump.
Sure. And he knows that. You know, I think one of the – this is a sort of a half-formed thought. Most of my thoughts are half-formed. But, you know, something I've been mulling is thinking about the media game that Trump is good at, which is basically the New York tabloid gossip game. And he has basically brought those tactics to mainstream serious journalism, you know, in a political sphere where the stakes are much higher. But also mainstream serious journalism has become basically that tabloid model. And so it's just kind of a perfect match in many ways. And again, Trump is both the symptom and the cause for a lot of these problems. But this media landscape existed before Trump came along, and he's simply just taking advantage of it.
Because of his experience as a reality show host?
Yeah. I think he thinks of himself as an entertainer. I mean, you know, I don't want to do too much pop psychology here. But whenever I've been to Trump events, it's clear that there's a fundamental level of him that thinks that he is an entertainer. And this morning, he actually got some pushback from, I think it was Hugh Hewitt of all people, about the founder of ISIS comment, which is the statement of the day, which, by the way, I will add, that is a, you know, serious thing that deserves scrutiny.
Absolutely.
But his response to, you know, questions about, well, why did you choose that language? Why did you decide to call President Obama, the founder of ISIS. His response to that is, the people loved it. Did you not see the people in the audience? They were eating it up. And that is, I think, fundamentally, to some extent, why he seizes his role, is to entertain the people in front of him and to get attention.
Has he cowed the media from your perspective?
Cowed them to what?
To not ask him? Certain questions like birther questions or tax questions, things like that?
I don't know if he's cowed him because I also think that there was a while, at least in the primaries, this notion of like, oh, the media created Trump because they gave him a pass and they didn't go after him. I actually think there's been pretty good reporting on Donald Trump, and there's been a lot of scrutiny, as is merited, and I think Hillary Clinton deserves the same level of scrutiny. Sure. But what he has done is he's scrambled the media and just made it hard to basically hold on to one thing, and so the substantive critiques get lost in the shuffle.
That's Jody Avirgan, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, podcast host and producer at 538, and we're talking about the coverage of Donald Trump as he has said, and I have said something that I think that anyone that has a broadcast show has to wrestle with, or a podcast show. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, Jody, 538, of course, known for the kind of polling you do, and I'm looking at something, I guess, hot off the press, and this is where it requires a fair amount of dissection. Who will win the presidency? Chance of winning, 84.7%, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, 15.3%. Now, someone could look at that and say, you know, it's a blowout. But how do we interpret those numbers?
Well, first, I'll just add that, you know, my job is mostly to go on our podcast and ask the people who create these models these questions that you just asked me. But I'll tell you what I think I've learned, which is basically, one, you know, polling is a snapshot in time. We do these projections. So, yes, right now in one of our projections, Trump has around a 15% chance of winning. To me, the way I think that's instructive to think about it is paths and number of states and combinations of states that Donald Trump needs to put together in order to win, and that Hillary Clinton needs to put together in order to win. And right now, Donald Trump's paths are just narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. And so you can think about it just in terms of a small collection of states like New Hampshire and Ohio and Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina. All these states are leaning towards Hillary Clinton, if not safe. And when you take one of those states off the board, all of a sudden there's has this ripple effect, this cascade. So, you know, you, even a state like New Hampshire, you take New Hampshire off the board for Donald Trump, and all of a sudden he has to basically run the table with a lot of these other states. So that's kind of how I am thinking about it right now. I'm, you know, there's that big flashy number at the top of our forecast.
Yes.
But I'm really looking at the sort of electoral math, because that's what it comes down to.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Paula. What if the media treated everything Trump said and as a joke and let him make the proactive steps of clarifying that he's not joking? And I guess what she's saying is again, asking those hard questions, or perhaps even those follow-up questions.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem there, or one thing I think about there, is just that then you're kind of buying the premise, right? And I do think we need to hold someone who uses words in public this way, especially when they're running for this office, accountable, right? I mean, there is, I think, a fundamentally different relationship with words for Donald Trump than for basically every other person who has ever been done what he's trying to do. And the question is, are we going to buy that premise and say, okay, words are kind of more malleable now and you can say something, and then it's an iterative process. Words are an iterative process. And you say something and then you kind of tweak it the next day, and you tweak it the next day. Or are we going to say words have always meant something, especially for someone who's running for president, and we're going to hold them accountable? But I don't know what the answer is there. I hope it's the latter, but you know, we'll see.
Well, and I think one of the questions that sort of hung out over this whole thing is what is a disqualifier? And it just raises questions about, and frankly, I thought last summer when he said what he said about John McCain, I still have not recovered from that. But it is so interesting whether there are different rules that apply to Donald Trump and apply to everybody else.
Yeah, I think he would like to think so. Actually, you say Donald Trump and everybody else. I actually think Trump uses words and language in the way that most people do, which is they say something. They float ideas. They are kind of used tone to convey that they're not really being serious. But like, I don't want a president – like, that's the scariest thought in the world, that a president would be like me, right? I want our president to be like serious and thoughtful and much smarter than I am. But I think Trump is in a room. He's having a good time, and that sort of is his main thought, is he's entertaining people.
Jody, about 45 seconds before I have to say goodbye to you. So are you enjoying your podcast hosting?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I like talking to you, but my main job is talking to the very smart people at 538, and I like being able to just pick their brain. And frankly, I think our show is at its best when we just kind of sit around a table and go, okay, like, what the heck is happening, and try and figure it out, and hopefully we can help our listeners along the way.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Go Eagles.
Oh, my goodness. Someone that actually says that. And I have to say, our engineer just exploded in front of me.
Well, I got Philly roots. So
oh,
I'm
you
wearing
do?
A Phillies
oh.
cap right now.
Oh,
I wore
go.
It for this interview. So, yeah.
Oh, well, we appreciate that, even if we can't see you. Yeah, Jody, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
You got it.
And that's Jody Avergan, podcast host and producer at 538. Well, there's some exciting changes coming to Radio Times. Mary Cummings Jordan is a longtime broadcaster, a familiar voice as the fill-in host for Radio Times. She's also been a reporter, a news anchor, hosted specials for WHYY, including the DNC this summer and the Pope's visit last September. Well, Mary is joining the Radio Times team and will be hosting the show on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for Hour 2, beginning next week. You'll also be hearing more from the Radio Times producers, bringing you unique stories and interviews that we will be featuring during the week as well. I will host the first hour of the show Monday through Friday, beginning next week, and I will continue as executive producer, and you'll be hearing me on Thursday, hour 2. So it is still Radio Times that you know. We'll be bringing you the news from the Delaware Valley, across the country, around the world. We'll be introducing you to fascinating people and ideas, and always giving you a chance to participate before, during, and after the broadcast. So it's Radio Times, new and improved. Madison Poulter helping us out today. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.